want to discuss in this lecture is a very kind of important concept that is important not only to conformal field theories but to quantum systems in general, including non-relativistic quantum mechanics, which is, so you're all familiar with the notion of symmetries as playing an important role in physics. What I'll describe to you is something that is equally, and even in a certain sense, even more powerful than symmetries, which are anomalies of symmetries, of global symmetries. So I want to discuss a little bit about anomalies. So there's an infinite number of things that one can say about this. So here, I will just discuss one way to think about them. And I'll choose, for obvious reasons, the example of anomaly in conformal symmetry. But actually, in one of the exercises or tutorial, or whatever the name is, you'll study anomalies associated to chiral symmetries in Young-Mills theories. Actually, not even, well, yeah, in electromagnetism, that play an important role there. And also, the reason I discussed conformal anomalies that, so in the previous lectures, I discussed that in the space of field theories, there is this quantity that we can associate to CFTs, a height function, that gives an ordering in the space of conformal field theories that tells us which CFT can be obtained from another one. And in even dimensions, that quantity that is the height function will be precisely the conformal anomaly. So, and we will see that this quantity, which is extremely powerful because it constrains non-perturbative RG flows, is extremely simple. Well, it's extremely simple, it appears in an extremely simple way in the theory, yet it has very powerful consequences. Okay, so the way we're going to start is, as usual, start simple. So we're going to start forgetting about, for now, about conformal field theory and just ask the following question in the style of things we've done before. What is the most general two-point function in a Lorentz invariant theory of the energy momentum tensor? Okay? So, something that I'll do a little bit different than what I've done in the lecture, in which perhaps differently than you're used in the field theory course, where you usually do many things in momentum space, like you do loop integrals in momentum space and so on. While in conformal field theory, it was, in a sense, more natural to discuss position space correlators. For this particular question, it will be convenient to go back to a momentum space. We can do that because the theory has scales, has translational invariance, so I can just go to the Fourier basis. So we want to study the following object. So I'll skip some steps that are kind of straightforward and just highlight the important ones. So we're going to take an energy momentum tensor, T mu nu, the Fourier transform of it, with momentum P, and momentum conservation will take this guy to be T rho sigma minus P. And at the first step, what I'm going to write is on the right-hand side, the most general thing that obeys the following rules, that is consistent, compatible with Lorentz symmetry. So can someone give me an example of a term that I could write down here that would be compatible with Lorentz symmetry? So remember, there is always the minus one rule that the number of indices have to match. That's one step. So how can you make the, we're in flat space, okay? So the ingredients are what? The ingredients are the metric and the momentum, right? So just give me one structure that you can write down that at least is not ruled out by this criterion.
M in U eta sigma.
That's one, yeah. Times some function that we cannot determine of P squared, right? Which is the Lorentz invariant quantity. Okay, another one.
And you put 4p's?
Who forbids that? So you can, yeah. Whatever, f1, f2. Is this the unique structure that you can construct with the metric?
Eta np, eta pp.
Or you can also eta pp, but yeah, so there will be terms with eta pp, but I was asking now whether is there some other term that you can write that only with the etas and no p?
Can you cross? Like
yeah, you can cross them. Yeah, so something like, yeah, I won't write it. So now you have to be careful to make things symmetric, right? So we'll have to be, whatever you write will have to be symmetric in mu nu and rho sigma and so on. Okay, so if you sit down, maybe not in a Friday afternoon, but you know, after 10 minutes you will realize that what you can write here is 5 different structures. Essentially, you can write 2 with 2 etas. Yes?
Could you recall why we need to put p and minus p and not arbitrary p and q?
I could have done that, but then I would have to carry around a nagging delta function here of delta 2 p plus q.
Why is it like this?
That's called translational invariance. So actually, this delta will come back later. So not in order not to keep this guy around all over the place, I'm solving for the delta function. So I'm going to solve for p equals minus q. But the fact that there is a delta here, a hidden delta, delta in some sense of 0, will be important later when we do dimensional analysis, because the delta function has dimensions. So when we do dimensional analysis, we will figure it out. We will need to remember about that. So that there will be 5 structures, 2 that have no momenta, 2 that have 1 momenta, 2 momenta and 1 metric, and 1 that has 4 momenta, which is this one. Okay. So this is very easy to write down. Now we're going to use the following important fact that the energy momentum tensor obeys an important property, which is the statement that it's conserved. So we have a conserved energy momentum tensor, which in momentum space just means that p mu nu equals 0. And this is true for all components, and you know, for any, I can contract for different p's and this will be true. Now, if I apply this here, this will give certain relations between the various terms, right? Because, for example, some terms that had 4 p's, well, by contracting with p's, you will see that different terms will mix, and they'll have to vanish. Okay, so this will impose a certain number of relations. Is the idea clear at least? Right. So let's see. Here's an example. So if I act here with some p, I'll have something linear in p. If I act with p on the quadratic term of p, in one of them I'll get p squared. So which will be, you can reabsorb in the function of p squared. So you'll have now a term linear in p that can combine with this one, and so on and so forth. Okay. So after you're done with this little exercise, there are 2 independent functions that you will have. And I'm going to write it using a slightly suited tensor that, in a sense, makes manifest the fact that there's conservation automatically obeyed. So do you know of a 2 tensor that automatically obeys this relation? Can you think of one? A tensor that you construct out of the metric and the momenta. You've seen things like that in QED.
P nu minus eta p squared.
Exactly, yeah. So we introduce this I mean, this clearly obeys P mu pi mu nu equals 0, or pi nu, OK? And let's record for later. Sorry, so that's property number one. Let's record for later another thing that we will need is what is the trace of this tensor. The trace of this tensor, which is eta mu nu pi mu nu, is essentially 1 minus the space-time dimension p squared, right? And we'll come back to this when we need it. OK, so now, after you've done this rather simple thing and then some linear algebra, you get 3 equations. So the number of different structures will go from 5 to 2, which I will write in a way that will make manifest some Lorentz properties and conservation. So I'm going to write this as, so the output of this exercise is this. So I'll use some definitions that are useful for me. So pi mu rho pi mu sigma plus, is that what I want? Let me see. Plus pi pi rho sigma, some f of p square, and then a pi mu pi rho sigma, some other function. Let's call it g of p square. Now, is it clear that in this way of writing, it's clear that condition number 2, conservation, is automatic, because if I hit with any of the 4 p's, all terms vanish automatically. Now, the reason I split into this form is that you can think of the contribution of this guy. Now, you can check that this guy is a symmetric traceless tensor. Okay, so you could think of this as the spin zero exchange contribution, and this is the spin two exchange contribution, and this will be the spin zero exchange contribution. They transform into two different irreducible representations of the Lorentz group. Okay. Now, let's specialize for simplicity to 2 dimensions, because the conformal anomaly is simpler in 2 dimensions than in 4 dimensions, for example. So let's go to 2 dimensions. In 2 dimensions, something very special happens. Essentially, in 2 dimensions, this term vanishes. So in d equals 2, first term vanishes. Now, there are many ways of seeing this. One way that makes it manifest is that in 2 dimensions, you can write pi mu nu as pi mu tilde, pi nu tilde, like the product of 2 momenta, where pi mu tilde is epsilon mu rho p rho. Okay. And the way you can, well, you can just prove that that gives you that. The identity you have to use is something that you probably have seen before, an identity between Levi-Civita tensors. So if you have 2 epsilon tensors here, and if you replace it by this, you get exactly that. Okay. Now there is one way you can think about this that maybe will look something more palatable. What I can do, or something that you already know. So I can multiply this guy by a two by two matrix twice. Okay. So multiply by some matrix. Now, if you put 2 m's here, let's call that matrix M, it's a 2x2 matrix, an arbitrary 2x2 matrix. Something that you remember from linear algebra is that when you have the product of matrices and you have the indices of the matrix contracted with the epsilon tensor, that's the definition of the determinant of the matrix. So this is just this identity, when you contract it this way, it turns into something that you're probably familiar with, which is the determinant of the matrix of an arbitrary matrix M is, so here you're going to get the trace of the matrix. So if you keep track of factors of a half, you would get 1/2 of, so here, okay, to be concrete, I'm going to multiply this by the matrix M mu nu M alpha beta, okay? Here you get a determinant. Actually, strictly speaking, you get here twice the determinant. And now if I multiply by this, you get the trace of M square, right? Because I just get the trace of this matrix and the trace of this matrix. And this term is the trace. Now you get one trace, but it's a trace of M square. Okay? And you can just check that a 2x2 matrix, any 2x2 matrix satisfies this property. So that's just the relation we're using here. Nothing sophisticated at all, I mean. And that is something that probably you've played before, so. Okay, so what does this make manifest? That in two dimensions, the coefficient of this guy is 2, right? I'm gonna put d equals 2, so there will be a 2 here. But now you see you have two terms that are the product of 4p's with all of 4p tildes. So you have the product of 4p tildes, the sum of two terms with 4p tildes minus twice the same thing, so that vanishes. So in two dimensions, the two-point function is particularly simple. We have that t mu nu p t rho sigma minus p is just, okay, I'll change, okay, let's see, let me call it gp square, because this is not determined, times pi mu nu pi rho sigma. Okay? Good. So this is a true for any Lorentz invariant, Poincaré invariant theory. Now we want to start imposing other things. We want to start imposing what happens when the theory is conformal, scale invariant. What does a scale invariant imply? You can imagine where we're going with this. I've hammered during the lectures that a diagnostic of conformal invariants is the vanishing of the energy momentum tensor, right? This was equivalent to conformal invariants. Actually, in two dimensions, you can prove that the scale invariance implies conformal invariants. So now what we're going to see is that this relation is violated in a subtle way, and that violation is precisely what we call the anomaly, the conformal anomaly. Okay, so now by dimensional analysis, we can fix what this function is of p square, because we know the dimension of everyone in the blackboard. So what is the function g? What is the function g of p square that you need to plug in there for scale invariance? Okay, so maybe, what is the dimension of t mu nu of p? Energy. Sorry?
What is one energy?
No, okay, so. Okay, what is the dimension of t mu nu of x? Okay, maybe I didn't really discuss this. What is the dimension of t mu nu of x?
It's an energy density.
So that means that it has dimension, dimension equals the space-time dimension. One way of saying it is that the momentum is obtained by integrating t over a space like hypersurface, and the momentum has dimension 1. So that tells you that the dimension of T mu naught has to be D. OK, so the Fourier transform, so but now we're looking at T mu naught of P. So that means that the dimension of this guy is 0, right? Because I am integrating over the dimensional space. To get to
the dimension of P is 0?
The dimension of T mu naught of P is 0 because I'm integrating, this is, what is this, right? This is what? D dx e to the ipx T mu naught of x. So this cancels that. So now we have that 0. OK, so 0 here equals 4. But now we have to work to this mysterious delta function that I didn't write. Delta 2 of p has dimensions of 1 over, delta of x has, delta of the argument has the dimension of 1 over the argument, right? So that means that it has dimension minus 2. So that means that g of p squared, in order for dimensions to match, should have the dimension 1 over p squared. Should be 1 over p squared. So what we find is that g of p squared is some constant c divided by p squared. Is this the logic clear?
Wait, sorry. The left-hand side should be unitless, right? So shouldn't g be 1 over p to the fourth?
No, that's the point. So this has p to the fourth.
Yeah.
But this delta has dimension 1 over p squared. So that has so that means that the delta, the hidden delta here, it gives you 1 over p squared times p to the fourth is p squared, which I cancel with 1 over.
In general, the delta would be minus d?
Sorry?
In general, the delta would be minus d?
Yeah, the delta function, since you integrate over something, has the space time dimension of this, has the dimension of the space time dimension, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'll do something that is slightly illegal, but I will do it anyway. So I'll just erase this and write this here to avoid writing some stuff. Okay. So that's it. So that's the most general two-point function for the conformal invariant theory. Now, if we Fourier transformed this into position space like we've done on most of the course, the Fourier transform of 1 over p squared is 1 over x to some power. So what you will find if you Fourier transform to position space is that the two-point function will have some part, some numerator that's fixed by Lorentz symmetry, and then it will fall off, well, like 1 over x to the 2 delta of the energy momentum tensor, which is twice the dimension. But doing it in momentum space will help us uncover something interesting. Because now we can ask, so we found the most general two-point function that makes manifest Lorentz symmetry. Now we can ask, what happened to conformal invariants? Now let's look at this equation and let me look at the trace. So now let's look at the trace of the energy momentum tensor in the correlation function. So all I have to do is, you know, contract that with eta. And now we find something that starts looking interesting. Because this, if I contract this with eta, so here I get the trace of the energy momentum tensor, which is the order parameter, if you wish, for broken conformal, for conformal symmetry. But the right-hand side is not zero, right? I had this little lemma here. Calling it a lemma is pathetic, because it's not even a lemma, but this thing that, you know, if I contract pi with eta, you get p squared, okay? So this guy definitely does not vanish, but actually will cancel this p squared. So what we find is that t mu mu at p, t rho sigma at minus p equals some c that is not determined. Times, I'm forgetting about factors of 2 and so on, pi rho sigma. Is it clear what I did here? So you may worry that this is a violation of conformal symmetry because the trace of the energy momentum tensor in a correlation function is no longer zero. I get something on the right-hand side. So the question is, what's going on? So what's going on is that the theory has a, this is exactly the conformal anomaly. But what I want to emphasize is that the violation of conformal symmetry is of a very special type when we are in flat space. It will be a different story when once we couple the theory to curved space. But in flat space, it's a violation of a very special type. Okay? Now, let's imagine that we go to position space. What kind of term will you get on the right-hand side if I go to position space now? So this pi is just a polynomial of momentum, right? Just a zero-order term and a p-squared term. What's the Fourier transform of that thing? This is not meant to be a tricky question. What is the Fourier transform of one, of number one?
Delta.
Delta? So what will be the Fourier transform of a polynomial?
Derivatives.
Sorry?
Derivatives.
Derivatives of delta. Okay, very good. So let me go now to position space. So this thing now will have there will be a delta function here, delta 2 of x. And all I have to do is act the Fourier transform. I mean, we're not from quantum mechanics, right? So you replace p mu by d mu, essentially. So what you're going to get is something like d mu d nu minus eta mu nu acting on that. What this tells us, this was meant to be d mu mu, right? So what this tells us is that there is a violation of the energy momentum, of the trace of the energy momentum tensor vanishing, but only at x equals zero. So you can, if you look at correlation functions in your theory between operators that are at separate, what we call at separated points, that they do not collide, the theory is conformal invariant. But the minute that you bring two operators on top of each other by colliding x with zero, you find a very specific violation of conformal symmetry. And that's exactly the conformal anomaly, which is a local violation. It only has support, so it's a local violation. With support only at x equals zero. We will now see soon that this violation at coincident points becomes a violation at separated points once I couple the theory to a metric. We will see how that happens. Now, you could have said, why don't I cancel the anomaly by just saying that C has to be zero? Then there is no anomaly, right? Because the right-hand side is zero. But you cannot really do that because if you put C equals zero, not only, you cancel the anomaly, but you do something worse. Yeah, you kill the whole two-point function. It is unphysical to have the two-point function of the energy momentum tensor to be zero in a physical theory. So this violation of conformal symmetry is unavoidable. Now, you might think that this is a bad thing, but actually it's an extremely good thing because, as I said, there is a lot of physics behind this funny number C. I call it C because remember that I talked about C theorems and C functions? That's the reason, because that's exactly the C we were talking about back then. Okay. Any questions about this? Yes.
So how does it know to be anomalous at exactly x equals zero? Like, shouldn't it be translationally invariant or something like that?
It is translationally invariant, right? I could have put here x, y, and then it would be x minus y. But let me not do that, okay? Can I put...
Yeah.
Now, we're not violating, we respect transitional invariance.
And the other thing is, so I mean, C could have been zero, right? You're not saying that it has to be an anomaly, just if there is an anomaly, it would be admissible. There's no reason for that C could be zero all the time.
Well, so you could have said that. The first thing that I think you would worry if that was true is that your theory would not be very physical, because you would look at the correlations of energy with energy here and you would always get zero. Next week, you're going to prove that actually unitarity, which means that, unitarity means that your Hilbert space has only a state with a positive norm, implies that C has to be positive, cannot be zero. So actually, this is not something I'm explaining self-containedly here, but I read it from this physical argument that it doesn't really make sense to have the two-point function of the energy momentum tensor vanish at any point, like close by, set by one. But unitarity implies that C is bigger than zero.
Wait, so you can never have conformal symmetry?
No, but that's why I'm being very careful with choosing my words. So remember that we derive all the constraints of the correlation functions of local operators. Those are not unchanged, because in when we did that analysis, one important assumption is that you were looking at the correlation function of operators at separated points. And this violation is only at coincident points. Now, as we will see now, once you couple this to background metric, and that's the usual context in which people talk about conformal anomalies, you will see that this violation is in your face. It's not only coincident points, it's kind of T mu mu will have a right-hand side, which is an operator, some structure that will be proportional to the identity operator. So it will be true everywhere. But the reason I went through this analysis is that one point I want to make, and that is this is true of all anomalies, by the way, is that anomalies can be detected by studying the theory, quote unquote, in flat space. You don't have to couple the theory to a background metric, which is what would be relevant, say, for conformal or gravitational anomalies. For the case of gauge anomalies, those anomalies are made visible once you couple the theory to a background gauge field. Like if you have a U1 symmetry, you can couple that to a background electromagnetic field. And then that makes manifest the symmetry. My point is that all those anomalies can be seen even in flat space before you turn on the metric or the background gauge field. And you see that we didn't do, we just followed our nose and discovered this. We didn't do any very sophisticated thing. Just think clearly. Okay, so now I'm gonna express this conformal anomaly in a way that you may have seen before, in the way which is usually seen, which is in the context when you couple. So let's couple now the theory. A background metric, a small perturbation. So you are in flat space and there's a little gravitational wave like the LIGO one. And I want to see what happens to the trace of the energy momentum tensor in the presence of the gravitational wave. So that will be easy. We will derive the linearized response using this, okay? So what are we going to do? So we're going to compute T mu mu, say at the origin, I can put it's transitional invariant. In the theory, so I'll use this notation, but to mean in the theory where I have a metric perturbation, H mu nu. Okay? What does this mean? Is that I'm looking at T mu mu in the presence of this term. So how do I couple a theory to a gravitational wave? Through which operator do I do that? It's the energy momentum tensor again, right? Remember that the energy momentum tensor is what measures the linearized deviation of the metric. That's its definition, in a sense. So I can write this as E. I'm not going to worry about signs or I's or anything, just schematically. And factors of two and stuff like that. That's kind of trivial. In the theory with no metric. Are people happy with this equation? This is the way a poor man or woman in flat space couples the theory to a linearized gravitational wave. You just add a coupling of the gravitational wave to the energy momentum tensor. That's the definition of the energy momentum tensor. Does this make sense? Should I elaborate or?
Is there any determinant of energy here?
I'm doing linearized, so everything is linearized, so everything is one, yeah. Okay, so now we can compute this in the unperturbed theory. So now, what do I do? I just bring this guy down, right? So if I bring this guy down, I'm gonna get T mu mu at zero. Now, what is this?
It should be zero.
Zero. Plus the integral dx h rho sigma of x of the two-point function of t mu mu at zero with t rho sigma at x, right? Plus order h squared. And again, this is in the theory in flat space. That's like doing a perturbation theory, essentially. We're treating the coupling of the theory to the background metric like an interaction term. So we just bring it down. But we just computed this, right? This is exactly what this whole exercise was to compute precisely the two-point function of the energy momentum tensor. And with the trace, so we're looking at the two-point function of the trace times this. So let me write it here. This was C. D mu, D nu minus eta mu nu, box delta 2 of x. And now, how can I proceed? Well, what I can do is that this guy, instead of acting here, I can make it act here, right? I'm just integrating by parts, so, okay. So. Are people happy with this? So now all I can do to evaluate, I mean, there's a delta function, so obviously I want to use the delta function. It would be silly of me not to use the delta function. So what I can do is just instead of the derivative hitting here, I can hit it here and then integrate. So what does this give me? It tells you that t mu mu at zero when you couple it to a background metric to linear order, is equal to C times d mu, sorry, d rho d sigma minus eta rho sigma box h rho sigma. So this deserves to be in a box. So now notice that we see that the violation, once I copy it to the linearized metric, is proportional to the identity operator. It's non-zero everywhere, right? There is no delta function or anything here. And that's kind of one way in which you can discuss the gravitational anomaly by coupling the theory to a background metric. Now, if you couple the theory to a background metric and your theory has diffeomorphism invariance, what appears here should be a diffeomorphism invariant quantity that you can construct out of the background metric. And this would be the linearized form of that diffeomorphism invariant. So what is the linearized form of? Does that ring a bell? Again, now think physically, okay? So what's the dimension of this guy? It's dimension 2, right? Is the energy momentum tensor in position space in two dimensions has dimension 2. We said that the dimension of the energy momentum tensor is D in position space. Now I have to construct an object here that the homomorphism invariant, it's a scalar because there are no indices here, right? The random minus one rule. So what object has dimension 2 and has no derivatives and is the diffeomorphism invariant? It plays an important role in general relativity.
Ritchie?
Sorry?
Ritchie
scalar. Sorry?
Ritchie.
Ritchie scalar, yes. So this would be the this is the linearized form. Of the Ritchie scalar. So actually, if you went through the exercise and very carefully did this to higher orders, you would derive the fact that once you couple the theory to nonlinearly to the metric, what you find is C times precisely the Ritchie scalar. Again, this is important that this is in two dimensions. And if you wish, if you want to think in terms of operator terms, you could think of this as multiplying just the identity operator. So in the whole course, we discussed how T mu mu equals zero was a diagnostic. Now we see that once you couple it to a background metric, it's unavoidable that there's a violation of conformal symmetry. Now, you could do a similar exercise in other dimensions. So what happens in other dimensions? So again, one can do calculations or one can think. It's always first to think and then do the calculation. So let's start with D equals 3. Or for that matter, any odd dimension. Space-time dimension, right? Now, it's usually very useful in physics is that when you have an equation or something, you write, like we did there, you write everything that's consistent with minus one rules, dimensional analysis, stupid things like this. So before doing any calculation, what can I write here on the right-hand side in three dimensions that has the property that is an object that's constructed out of the background metric, right? Because now I couple my system to background metric. So whatever appears here, the violation is due to the background metric. If the background metric was trivial, we know that T mu mu was zero at separated points, right? And now there is no operator nearby. So if the metric was flat, T mu mu was zero. And indeed, famously, the curvature of the flat metric is zero. So in flat space, this is zero. So what could be right here that makes sense in three dimensions, say? Just guess something. Just guess it. And then we will see if it's right or wrong.
Ritchie to the power of 3 over 2.
OK, so that's a good guess. That's a good guess in the sense that it has the right dimension. But something that's very important, the reason she says R over 3 over 2 is that R has dimension 2. And so and that power will have dimension 3, just the, like the right-hand side. But actually, the terms that should appear here should be what we call local terms. So there should be terms that don't have any funny square root or anything like that. These are things that, so one thing that you know from just Feynman diagrams is that when you do a low energy expansion, the terms that you get in your low energy effective action are local terms. So these are things that are expansions of fields and derivatives, okay? you never had something that is kind of non-analytic, and R to the 3 halves is something that is sort of non-analytic, okay? So, but precisely because you cannot write down anything that is analytic and has dimension D, tells us immediately that there are no conformal anomalies. In odd dimensions, which is an important result. So we can only have conformal anomalies in even space-time dimensions, simply because in odd dimensions there is not something sensible that we can even write down. You could do this exercise that I did here in 3 dimensions and notice that, indeed, you get 0. But this is also another way to think about it in terms of the background metric. Now, in 4 dimensions, I'm going to write it because it's important for the C theorem in 4 dimensions. Something that I think I explained this in the notes, in some version of the notes. I don't know which ones Gang has. You can try to write down what is the trace of the energy momentum tensor once you couple it to a background metric in 4 space-time dimensions. And what you find is that instead of having one structure, you have 2 possible structures. So one is called A, and one is called C. So I will not write all the. So obviously, what I have to write here is a diffeomorphism invariant scalar constructed out of the metric that has dimension 4. And essentially, there are 2 things that at the end of the day appear here. One is the square of the Weyl tensor, which is a particular component of the Riemann tensor. And then there is something called the Euler density, which is a topological invariant, which is a particular combination with some funny coefficients that I will not get right, so I won't even try. So it's something like, it's a particular combination of Riemann square plus Ricci square plus R square, okay? With this very special property that it's topologically invariant. So if you integrate this gadget over a manifold, it gives you a number, which is called the Euler number of the manifold, okay? Okay. So one of the many, so this is of course important by itself, but one of the very reasons that these conformal anomalies are useful is the following, that in, so in 2 dimensions we have this guy. Now in 4 dimensions we have 2 of them, but it will turn out that this is the really exciting one. Notice that both C and A are the quantities that multiply the topological invariant. Famously, R is the Euler density in 2 dimensions. If you integrate R over a 2-dimensional surface, it gives you the Euler number of that surface. So the quantity that has a lot of physical content is the coefficient of the Euler density in the trace anomaly. So now let me just finish with a few words of how this connects to things I said before, of RG flows and blah, blah, blah. So the reason this is important is that we discussed that you can study many different RG flows in field theory, and asymptotically, if you start with a conformal field theory, you're going to end up with a conformal field theory. So we call CFTUB plus a relevant operator will trigger an RG flow that will land you on some other CFT IR. And so let me say 2 comments about this. The comment I want to make is that so in general, we don't know much to say about this theory because it is strongly coupled, and we don't have really tools unless you have some kind of non-perturbative tool to really study this, but in general, we don't. But something that you can say, that you can prove, which I'm not proving here, but I think it's also in the notes, actually, it's not very difficult. It essentially follows by combining cleverly the most general two-point functions of the energy momentum tensor in a Poincaré invariant theory and seeing that you can construct a quantity that satisfies a certain inequality, which decreases under RG flow. But in order to connect to the story we said here, there exists C theorems. It's funny because in two dimensions it's called C, in four dimensions it's called A. There are good reasons for that, but let's not get into that. That tells us that no matter what happens in a consistent theory, namely unitary theory, that this C, the conformal anomaly of the theory in the ultraviolet, has to be strictly bigger than the conformal anomaly of the theory in the infrared. So that would be the statement in two dimensions. The statement in four dimensions would be that A in the UV is strictly bigger to I in the infrared. Okay. So if you have a way of determining C or A in a conformal field theory, you can already establish a relationship, a logical relationship between various CFTs, whether one can be sits in this picture of a mountain, whether one sits higher or lower than one particular CFT. Okay. So, and that has gives lots of ways of constraining possible RG flows that you can construct. Now, I wanted to write the equals four. So now you may ask me, what about three dimensions? Is there something like that in three dimensions? And I'll just conclude by saying a few words about this. And the answer is yes. So what about odd dimensions? Now, in hindsight, the answer is very simple. There is something that is common to A and C in four dimensions, other than that they are the one of the terms in the conformal anomaly. The thing that was important is that this guy is the coefficient of the Euler density in two dimensions, or the Euler density in four dimensions. And if you want to fish out one way to measure A or C in two and four dimensions, simply because of the fact that if you integrate the Euler density over the sphere, it tells you the Euler number of the sphere, which is 2, okay? While, for example, if you're in four dimensions, if you integrate this guy over the fourth sphere, this is 0. Because the sphere is conformal to flat. Well, I don't know if you've discussed the Weyl tensor is a gadget that is a tensor that has the property that if the metric is conformally flat, which means that the metric looks like some factor times the flat space metric, then this implies that the Weyl tensor vanishes. Okay. So and of course the sphere has that property. The sphere is a conformally flat space. So if you integrate over the sphere, only A survives in four dimensions. So actually, the natural realization then to what dimensions was to look at the partition function of the conformal field theory, not in flat space, but on the d-dimensional sphere. In even dimensions, it kind of isolates Euler anomaly. So then you can define a quantity which is roughly speaking. Now here I'm cheating a little bit, but I think it's not a malicious lie. You can define kind of a free energy of the CFT. And now this quantity, which roughly speaking, which in even dimensions, roughly speaking, gives you the Euler anomaly, And in all dimensions, defines a new quantity that this quantity now has nothing to do with conformal anomalies because there are no conformal anomalies in all dimensions. But this gadget that we defined from the sphere still has the property that FUV equals FIR. So, in recent years, what has been discovered is that not only in even dimensions, but in even and odd dimensions, there is a quantity that has a monotonic property under RG flows, and that quantity is one universal way to talk about it for all dimensions is precisely as the free energy of the partition function of the theory on the round d-dimensional sphere. Okay, so I believe that in other lectures later on, you will study more properties of anomalies. This just were kind of was the tip of the iceberg of the kind of things that one can learn by studying anomalies. But I wanted to touch on it because of all these important things, but also because in kind of in recent research, the study of anomalies of various types for space-time symmetries, for global symmetries, for discrete symmetries, has played an important role in kind of solving strongly coupled problems in various dimensions. So somehow, even though this subject of anomalies is an old one, is one that's still kind of bearing fruit even today. Okay, so thanks.